You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Alec, in your presentation, you mentioned that and you just said the same thing, that young people are open to government solutions to some of these big, meaty problems. At the same time, we're so skeptical of big institutions, and we have a lot of reason to be quite cynical. And so I think we, because we are able to hold two truths at the same time, we need to pivot and think about different ways of kind of framing these issues. Big issues like climate, big issues like the debt. You know, one analogy, I don't know who here has a cable package. Yeah, not a ton of people.
I do.
Case in point.
I knew you were going to say that.
Well,
simpler.
You know, there's maybe a few channels that we want to watch or a few things that we're interested in, but there's more likely a lot more channels that we don't necessarily care about, or maybe channels that we very specifically avoid. I don't spend a ton of time watching like the MLB Classic channel, for example. And instead, go Nats. But instead, we're subscribing to things like Netflix or selecting our options more a la carte. And I think that's a good analogy for how we should be thinking about issues and tackling these big problems moving forward. We're trying to sell a cable package to a streaming generation, and we need to kind of pivot to recognize that we need to move the frame.
That's a very good analogy. yes, I mean, my daughters, who are both millennials, I have to text them because they don't respond to anything other than a text. Even if they're in the same room, I have to text them about exactly, you know, how do I change this channel and get what I want and this kind of thing. I don't know. They just do it for me, and that's, I find, very much more simple. I'd just like to pick up on something which I've heard in the research, and I wanted to see if you all agree that this is the case, which is one of the interesting things about younger people, and particularly in the issue of climate change, is the feeling, in part probably because of the disdain, the suspicion of larger institutions and so on, the desire to actually do something yourself to help deal with the issue. So, you know, getting a fuel-efficient car, worrying about your carbon footprint, and so on and so forth. How might that be translated, if it's true, and maybe Nat, you want to jump in on this, how might this be translated into something like the debt and deficit? Is there something that younger people do or could do to make a difference in their own mind for the future? I think it kind of weaves into this whole issue of solutions. You know, what is it you're trying to achieve, and what can I personally do to help get there? Is it possible to offer some ideas for younger people about actions they could do, given that Molly's told us to give up on Congress? You know, others have told us you know, you can't look at a package deal and so on. You've got to look at individual steps. What could those steps be, and are they meaningful? Anybody want to jump in on that? It's open to anybody.
Yeah, register to vote. So okay. I think that's the first
true.
Thing. I mean, to become an active member of this democracy and to make sure that your voice matters and that it's heard and that you also work with other groups and other stakeholders who can help amplify that voice. I think that's a major. It's great to be able to compost, and it's great to be able to get a fuel-efficient car, and to mitigate your own carbon footprint, and that's great. But we also need to also understand that there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to these issues, and that we have to be very intentional about what type of strategies we're offering to younger generations and generations like mine. Because, you know, I was figuring out whether I was going to say this or not, but I think I am.
Say it.
Our bullshit radars are incredibly honed, and we've been watching television for most of our lives, and we see a lot of elected officials tell us one thing and others tell us another. We have a president who says things that we laugh off now and that we've normalized in a certain way by saying, you know, it's just the president being the president. But for younger people, it's the president of the United States saying things, and that they're taking that to heart, and they're saying that potentially is true. So we need to be truthful. We need to be stark. We can't be hyperbolic. And unfortunately, the current administration doesn't really make that easy for us on any given day. But if we need a plan, a strategy on how young people can address growing deficits, it's to become a member of this democracy and register.
No, I think that's right. And again, I would never suggest giving up on Congress. But I do think that when we talk about, again, what motivates members, they do have to, you know, in the House, stand for re-election every 2 years. They have a lot of incentives to pay attention to and respond to the issues that their constituents are telling them to care about. And so for younger Americans, making sure that you are one of those people who your elected official is hearing from is, I think, incredibly important. Pew has documented the degree to which the share of the electorate that is in younger generations is growing. So I think we're sort of in that, we're going down that path already. But I would completely agree that that's one of the most important individual level behaviors that folks can engage in if they care about these issues.
Mm-hmm. I also think just, you know, Mr. Kilmer's point about the solution being localized is so important, and that's perhaps why we've seen so much success at the state level in moving energy or climate-related bills. And I think the more that we can put our messengers in people's neighborhoods, in their communities, talking about things that they can see with real impact, whether it's potholes on their street or other issues that are being neglected because of this kind of larger existential issue, the more we can localize it, the more we can start to drive the urgency and draw a bright line between registering to vote and fixing this big problem. And I think what's missing is kind of that direct connection to your everyday life. And the more we can paint that picture and draw that bright line, the more we can start to create a coalition around it.
That's a really good point. I remember when Senator Warner was governor of Virginia and they were battling some pretty terrible budget issues. They had to close the DMV one day a week, and that got everyone's attention. Mm-hmm. That touched everyone across sectors, across political spheres, across ideologies. I think right now one of the obstacles that we have in front of us is that we look at debt as a very abstract concept, very far down the road. And so we have to balance. We have to make sure that we're underscoring the severity of the issue without being too hyperbolic, without violating the trust of millennials. That is a fine balance that we have to do every single day.
I think this trust issue is it seems to me, very central to this. We had, since we announced this this event today, and I wrote a little piece related to it a couple of weeks ago, we've had a fairly lively input of reflections on both this event in advance and on the piece I wrote. And I'd say the gist of certainly most of the email that was sent to me or the Twitter that was sent to me, I think they cut out a lot of the language of some of them, but some of them that came to me, basically said, you people, and I think he means, this person meant economists and people at think tanks and people roughly my age, have been telling us every decade, you know, from the 60s, 70s onwards, that within 10 years, there's going to be economic disaster. And it just doesn't happen. And now you want us to believe it again? Why should we pay extra taxes, reduce benefits, and so on, cut things, when you've never been true in the past? And I think that's a big challenge for us. So I think trust is an issue. And then I think also translating to the locally, as you said, is really interesting. I mean, on the face of it, I would feel in general that climate change should be harder to do that because climate change involves the whole world, other countries, and so on. So to kind of personalize that would be very difficult. But I think, as Leila said, it has been successful. There are steps. People see this in a very direct way. And I just wonder again, what is it one could imagine in the debt and deficit area that could be made much more personal? Is it that we should be encouraging people to save more? Should we be encouraging people to have a better lifestyle and improve their nutrition so they will need less medical care from Medicare in the future and so on? What's the individual action that could be equivalent here?
It's not political paternalism, I can tell you that.
Right.
I think people on both sides of the aisle have had enough of that, telling us what certain people can use with their SNAP benefits, telling people that we have to pee in cups in order to get social services. We're done with political paternalism, okay. I think, as a strategy to employ. I'm happy to say I represent a party that doesn't do it that much, but it's something that we do have to move away from. But I think we need to start calling people out. I think, again, we're back to this trust idea, right? We cannot, you know, we cannot afford to help the most vulnerable among us, but we can afford to go to war in places that we shouldn't have, you know, any type of conflict with. We can't revamp the healthcare system. It's way too expensive, but we can do billion-dollar tax cuts for the top 1% in this country. It's a duality of inconsistencies, and I think a big strategy is making sure that we are calling out those who are giving us talking points as opposed to truth, and heighten this conversation to the degree where it should be about something as important as climate change, which is an existential threat for this world, and the debt, which it could be a major threat to the most vulnerable among us right now. And let's humanize that. Let's put a human face on that so that we, again, are starting to not just tell someone something, but tell a story that people can identify with, connect with, like Congressman Kilmer had underscored mm-hmm. earlier.
Nat, maybe I could put you on the spot on this in terms of from what you laid out. And for this conversation you've heard so far, what have you heard that really strikes a chord with what the research is you made? Is it what Eric's just said? Is it what Layla said?
So I've got about 5 pages of notes that I've taken in the last 10 minutes. So
that's one page is sufficient.
Yeah, one page is sufficient. So I think the last 5 minutes are really kind of talking, not talking around as in avoiding it, but kind of circling around this common conundrum with both of these issues, which is fundamentally the solution is not individual action, right? It's not, the solution to climate change is not turn out your lights. It's not compost. So I think that when you kind of look at that, together with this people's need for efficacy, you have kind of a second layer of conundrum. So if the solution is not individual action, but if people need efficacy in order to engage, then you kind of have this tension. And my thinking is largely where Eric, is that right?
Yes.
Eric and Layla talked about kind of the importance of civic engagement as the individual action that I think is most important and appropriate on these issues. So you know, I've been thinking a lot and kind of waiting, yearning to do work on how you frame kind of basics of civic participation to the American public in a way that encourages a better understanding of what a democracy is and how it works, which I kind of think we have forgotten in some ways. A lot of the funders who fund our work are interested in funding ideas of civic participation in democracy in far-flung places like Kenya or Bangladesh. But I think a lot of that work needs to be redirected towards the context in which we live and talking about civic participation in this country. I think it's also, so one other quick thought is a really key difference between two concepts. One is personalization and the other is individualization. So personalization, yes, right? So that we need to frame things in a way that resonates with people and that moves them in a direction. But the direction that we move them in cannot be individualistic. It cannot encourage people to think that problems are caused and solved by the will and character of individuals. To me, in the work that I've done over the last 12 years, that is one of the most obstinate challenges to the change work that I'm trying to be part of. The way in which people conceptualize these really complicated issues as being kind of narrowly about the will, grit, gumption, drive, choice of individuals, and how that occludes the, and this sounds a little geeky, but the systemic perspective that is necessary to engage in if we are actually going to address these big issues. So personalization, yes, by all means, but individualization, I think, is a danger of we're in danger of conflating those two things in this discussion. So I would encourage us to think about that.
Everybody agree with that?
I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know how I can agree with that when I know that individuals are the reason right now that the House of Representatives is blue. I think a lot of people individually looked at the trajectory of our country and thought, I may be just one person, but I'm going to do what I can to turn my district from red to blue, or to vote out someone who doesn't represent my values and doesn't help enrich or help improve the quality of my life. I think when you get individuals together in a group, I think that is when you actually start seeing those movements start to take shape and come to fruition. But I agree. I think we can't conflate the personalization component to it either. I think we need to be able to play in both pools. But I am the son of baby boomer parents who remind me every other day that they ended the Vietnam War and that they were in the streets and that they saw their friends go, and individually they felt powerless, but they individually worked with their local groups, SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. These are young students who just did it on their own, and they say they ended a war. And I got to tell you, I believe that. And I like being able to underscore the idea that that even on your own, that you have the capacity to do something amazing, not just for yourself, but for your community and quite possibly your country.
Yeah, I think, can I just jump in?
Absolutely.
And I think both are actually kind of right. And just going back to the chart that you had up on the screen, Nat, of the low efficacy, high urgency, and thinking about where we want to be in those quadrants, we're not living in a vacuum. And at any given moment, there's so many different of those quadrants being filled by so many different issues. And I think back to your point, Stuart, about trust, I think we're talking about this and we're framing this conversation in how can we get the public to trust the policymakers in terms of how to create a solution. But I think we also have a challenge in getting policymakers to trust each other too. And we're not going to be able to separate the urgent and the important if we think that everybody else who's working on other urgent matters is not to be trusted. And so we have to double check their work. And while we're all double checking each other's urgent work, all the big important stuff is getting left for the next generation to solve. And so I think there's a crisis of trust internally as well, before we can even think about, how do we personalize this for the public? How can we create this culture of trust internally among policymakers as well? And I think kind of just speaking to your points about the challenges and frustrations of how to move issues forward, it comes back to that initial point of all understanding is based on framing, and we need to shift our framing within our legislative bodies even before we can start to have that trickle out to the public.
And we're living, as you know, I think one of the things that Alec opened his remarks with is we're living in this period of extremely high polarization. And so the degree to which that and the incentives for short-term thinking just towards the next election among members of Congress make it difficult to build that kind of trust that is necessary to tackle longer term problems as opposed to just sort of shorter term problem focused conversations more than solutions focused conversations is another way that structurally I think Congress faces challenges in this area.
Let me open it up now to the audience and to Twitter. You can send in questions. Oh, we have one here, which I'll take in a moment. Maybe if we could just start in the center here.
My name is Susan Irving. I'm struck by the tension of your point about we're selling to a cable we're trying to sell a cable package to a streaming generation. And yet, if you look at the list of all the things people won't cut, and you add to that the list of people opposed to raising taxes, the only way to address the substance of the long-term fiscal challenge is to do both. How do you do that by letting people pick and choose? Because you generally, what you get is a package that won't work. So basically, how do we frame that issue so that it's a deal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that, anyone else jump in, but I think the spirit of my comment is more about the messaging itself about how to disentangle the idea of action on this long-term issue without assigning other completely unrelated issues just because of who the messenger might be or because of other things that you might know to be true about that individual or that kind of institution. And so I think you're totally right. There is a big compromise that's going to need to be made to be able to take issue. But as we think about how do we separate facts from identity almost, and that to me seems to be one of the biggest challenges that we're facing and mm-hmm. and even taking the first step on this issue.
Okay. Maybe over here.
My name is Jim Connors. Interestingly, Congressman Kilmer framed the day when he spoke with pride about his grandmother living for 38 years on Social Security. Isn't that a terrific framing for how wonderful Social Security and entitlements is? From what I've heard today, and I came with this notion, the biggest problem facing millennials is their enemy is their grandmother. How would Nat frame that successfully?
Oh, that's not fair. Come on. Jeez.
Tell us how you hate grandparents.
I've got your grandmother on the line here.
Yeah, I'm not going to claim that I have the answer to that one. I do think that frames that create or prime zero-sum ways of thinking are incredibly toxic as they seep and spill past the issues in which we intend them to hold. Kind of othering and zero-sum thinking is one of my biggest concerns in doing the work that I do, and how easy it is for people to, with very little priming, to fall into that, to think about everything as being a competition. And once you're in that kind of zero-sum mode, anything that's able to be seen as for you and yours is by definition, I'm not pointing to anyone back there, is by definition less for me and mine. And so it's not a direct answer to your question, but I think that framing around the ideas of competition between groups is a really toxic frame, although in reality what you're saying is correct. So there's a difference between the social analysis and the communications analysis. So I'm in the communications analysis lane here.
Well, maybe one thing to add on this, kind of grounded in our research, is, you know, we try and ask people, to what extent do you perceive conflicts between older and younger people, better and less well-educated people, people of different races or different, you know, ages. And at least in a self-reported survey, people really don't see this generational divide. It's not really salient for them right now. It's not to say that it couldn't become more salient, but as we stand here today, it's not among the top conflicts that the public sees. And there are other questions. There's other research we do. Does the government do too much, too little, the right amount for older people or younger people? The divides you get in response patterns by age are perhaps more modest than you might have predicted. So at least in the survey data, we don't see this generational conflict as primed as you might see other forms of conflict in the country, at least at the current moment.
If I could just pick up on that, a reflection
really
on your question. Some years ago in the early 2000s, 2000 till the mid-2000s, when I was at the Heritage Foundation, Heritage and the Brookings Institution, with the General Accountability Office, the head of the General Accountability Office, and the Concord Coalition, undertook a project called the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour. And we actually went around the country talking at primarily colleges about these issues of long-term deficit and debt and the problems associated with that. And the audience, it was at colleges, but typically the audience was roughly half people who were student age, and the other half were basically people who could be their grandparents. So we actually precipitated a conversation along the lines you just said in terms of who's the problem, and that the older generations are, the baby boom generation, is in fact depleting the opportunities for the future. And so we had this kind of pretty robust conversation. And a potential reframing did develop during those conversations, not enough to get to public policy. And let me just kind of run this by Nat, see what he thinks about it. We had a lot of older people coming to the microphone, and they would say something like this. I hear what you just said about how we in Medicare and Social Security and so on are really draining the bank. And that this young person next to me, who's already got $50,000 of college debt. He or she is not going to have what I'm able. I'm willing to forego some of my benefits. I've got a 401k, I've got some money in the bank and so on, providing that Social Security and Medicare, I know, is going to be there if I need it and be sufficient if I'm running out of money in some way. I'm willing to give up, and I'm also willing to do that to reduce benefits in something like Medicare, providing I don't get Alzheimer's. In other words, providing I don't get something which is going to mean I'm going to be enormous expense. So what was going on, it seemed to me, was a reframing to say, if we think of these retirement programs not as something I expect as a stream of income and a stream of benefits, but something that's there as an insurance policy against things going badly. And we had a lot of traction with that. Not enough to get legislation passed, I have to confess, but it was a reframing. Is that the kind of reframing any of you think might get some traction in a broader audience today, or are we too far beyond that?
I would say it's never too late to try and reframe the conversation. And and going back to your comment, Jim, was it? Grandma's not the enemy, but the enemy is the environment and attitudes that cultivated grandma's ideology right now, that this is not my particular problem. I will have this. I think it becomes redefining the metrics as well. So I'm from California, Southern California. I'm from a suburb of L.A. called Calabasas. Last year, we had a major fire, the Camp Fire, that destroyed lots of homes. Northern California fire claimed the lives of dozens of people. I will tell you that my friends who are Republicans, who did not believe in climate change before that fire, do now. And it's because they had the head of CAL FIRE explain, you know, wherever your political ideology is, that's fine, but climate change are making these fires stronger, they're increasing the volume, and they're making it more dangerous for everyone. So when we think of climate refugees, I think a lot of people think of people whose homes were buried underwater. We now need to reframe that and start thinking about people who no longer have homes because they are now burned up. And I think figuring out different ways to stay, as a communications professional, I'm going to throw this out there, to stay message disciplined without saying the same thing over and over again, but finding new ways to underscore the stakes and be able to redefine the metrics there. I think that will help us. And I don't think it's ever too late to try that, because something as important as climate change or debt needs, we can't give up on the third try. We got to keep trying. I think that's the whole point.
I certainly think we need to reframe the issue. Anybody else want to jump in on that? If not, I'll go to another question. There's a gentleman here.
Thank you. I'm Dave Rabinowitz. In 2000, the U.S. government ran a surplus in the budget, and people were talking about finally starting to pay down the debt. And polls typically said about 50% of the people said you should use the surplus to pay down the debt. There was this one poll where only 6% said pay down the debt. And I looked into it and discovered that there was no option that said pay down the debt. The option was don't spend it, which is equivalent to pay down the debt. But it didn't sound that way. And it turns out in polls in general, the results depend more on the wording of the questions, the order of the questions, and the script in general than on the actual opinions of the respondents, which is why polls generally support whatever position the funders want to support. I'm wondering, are there more polls of millennials based by organizations that have different positions, and do their results look similar to the ones that Pew found?
Yeah, I think that I can take that.
You were going to get it anyway.
Yeah, right? No, it's certainly true that the wording you use in a question, the order, or what themes you might prime can influence opinion. The effect of that is greater or larger depending on how deeply held those opinions are today. For example, you could prime a lot of things in front of Trump approval, and my expectation would be it wouldn't change a whole lot because those attitudes are deeply held by the public and they have strong reasons for believing the way that they do. So it's more often the case that on lower salience issues you could see potentially more of an effect in the results based on how the question is framed or written. you know, we're a nonpartisan, non-policy organization. Part of what we spend our days really grappling with is how to write this in the fairest, most neutral way possible. So we're very confident in our estimates, and I certainly would stand behind them. But to your question, could you get different results based on how it's framed? Absolutely. And I guess what I would say, though, some of the enduring dynamics are very robust across different wordings. For example, the large partisan divide and concern over climate change. Word the question however you like, and you're going to get that large partisan divide. So I think my overall answer, of course it matters. It matters more for low salience issues, but some dynamics are so strong and so deeply held and so enduring that they'll express themselves across any type of wording you can come up with. And I think there are a lot of the same themes that we hit on today are robust across all methodologies.
I have a question from Twitter, through Twitter, which I think nicely juxtaposes both these issues. And the question is, would borrowing today, in other words, increasing debt today, to address climate change be a wise investment for the future? In other words, should we go even deeper into debt to solve this other question?
Without a planet, I don't think the debt is going to be a major deal for us.
Okay.
So I think we should definitely be figuring out all of the options before us in terms of addressing climate change. And this can be from an individual standpoint, it can be from a group dynamic, it could be as a country, and particularly that has to start with leadership at the top. So we need to be able to have a government that will join its constituency in addressing those issues with the severity it demands. But I think when it comes to saving the planet, we should be open to a plethora of different options, and we should also be listening to a diverse standpoint of opinions as well. Congressman Gomez, who I work for, likes to underscore the idea of environmental equity when talking about climate change, that those who are most impacted by the effects of climate change should be thought of, should be prioritized in any type of legislative prescription that we're going to devise. When we talk about these issues, communities of color have a lot to say about them because they are, in most cases, more impacted by those negative effects than other communities. So making sure that we have a diversity of opinions and a diversity of viewpoints as to how to solve these issues and how to address them, that is, I think, the only way that we're going to be able to move the needle in any direction.
Layla, is that what you hear when you're out there listening to millennials?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a pretty compelling point. Without a planet to live on, there's not a whole lot of other issues that we can work on unless, I guess, we just, colonize the moon or Mars or something.
Yeah.
I'm struck by your comment about just engaging different constituencies, too, in this. We're actually about to do an event in a couple weeks around the issue of climate and energy out in Wisconsin, and we'll hear from MAPS founder Stephen in a little bit. I'm sure he'll slip in a Wisconsin reference at some point. But we're engaging the faith community around this issue with the idea of being good stewards of God's earth. And so thinking about how can you frame these messages in ways that make it urgent for people now, and I think, at some point you have to prioritize. Back to the original question of what can we do on an individual basis on the national debt, I think, sometimes it's a tough answer, but sometimes it's nothing. It's work on other issues first so that we are in a better position to more effectively solve the next problem and do the triage in the order of urgency.
Okay. Any other comments? Good. I want to thank the panel for walking us through this very complicated issue and for the two presentations, particularly at the very beginning. So thank you.
Thank you.
And now I want to welcome up just for some closing comments, Stephen Olicara. Stephen Olicara is the founder and president of Millennial Action Project, our co-host today, which is the largest nonpartisan organization of young lawmakers in the United States, working with over 800 policymakers.
Unemployment benefits and other assistance for middle-class families. And I remember reading the New York Times article at the time. I was sitting in my apartment in Madison, Wisconsin. I did get the Wisconsin reference in there. Seeing this one line after the compromise was laid out, and it says, these $900 billion over the next 2 years will be financed entirely with debt spending. So that's another way of saying these $900 billion will be financed entirely by young people and future generations. I remember sitting there thinking, who is actually in Congress looking and thinking about the future? This is a generationally inequitable and I think unmoral kind of compromise that these leaders are doing, and it was seen generally as a good thing. And that, to me, was a sign that we have the wrong frame and the wrong type of leaders in Congress. Second experience on climate change, and prior to starting MAP, I was pretty active in the climate change space. This was at the World Bank and working there on sustainable energy and climate change issues. We had just produced a wonderful report on sustainable energy and working on different power plants, how they can reduce their carbon emissions. I remember sitting down one day with the chief economist that summer, it's the summer of 2012, asking her, what are the main inhibitors to implementing our green growth strategy? Spent a lot of time on this report. Now, what are the roadblocks to implementing it? And she said there are three issues. One is financing, two is infrastructure, and three is political dysfunction. She said, I feel confident about solving the first two, and I'm absolutely hopeless about the third. And when we're talking about political dysfunction, the main feature in my view and the view of the founders of MAP was one of those main features is political polarization and intense partisanship. And it was in that time that we started to realize, as millennials, that these generational issues will not change unless we addressed that primary linkage of polarization and dysfunction with short-term policymaking. And that was referenced on the last panel. When you're governing in a crisis mode, from crisis to crisis, it's always easiest to either put a Band-Aid on or just to kick the can down the road and let someone else solve it in the future. But if you can reframe these issues in terms of future progress, then maybe you could build some unlikely coalitions. And by the way, there's Nat. Your slide that had future progress versus vulnerability, I was standing in the back thinking, God, I hope the bar is much higher on the left side. And it was. So thank you so much, Nat, for that slide. Very helpful and reinforces in many ways the premise of our organization. So thank you for that. And we realized that if you can frame it in terms of that future way and to your point about legacy thinking, it wouldn't just be about young people who are saying we need long-term solutions. It would also be more senior members of society. I'll never forget when we were launching the Congressional Future Caucus on the Hill, we had, of course, all of the few millennials at the time join the caucus. But on our way to the committee room, there were a number of more senior members, including then the oldest member of Congress, who came out of elevators, out of hallways, and they said, can we join your caucus? And we saw that happen at the state level, too. Usually the answer has been yes. And the reason is because we're seeing some of the most senior members of these legislatures saying that they want to, in your legacy framework, we want to leave a positive legacy. We want to leave the world better off for our children and grandchildren. And when you see it in that kind of nonpartisan frame, then you can start to throw a lot of different types of solutions from across the spectrum at the problem and look at it in a much more pragmatic way. One of the things I've realized over the last 7 years or so working on this sort of project with Millennial Action Project is that there are a lot of amazing ideas out there, and Brookings Institution is usually an author of those good ideas, and the Bipartisan Policy Center is another great author of good ideas. I've been in meetings where we look at the issue of the debt and look at the different policy levers that you can utilize to bring down the debt. Some are more right-leaning, some are more left-leaning, some are just down the center. And, of course, the assumption in those conversations is this is a great idea on paper, but there's a long way to go between idea to execution, and that's true. I believe one of the greatest challenges we have right now is being able to create a new type of leadership, a new way of governing to actually motivate action on these challenges. And we talk about the polls. I think we need to develop young leaders who don't just read the polls, but know how to change the polls. And that's a big piece of what we're doing with Millennial Action Project. I think great leaders can move people. They can move people to transcend their own self-interest, their own tribal interest, their own party's interest, and to get people to see themselves as part of a larger whole. There was a young President Kennedy who challenged people to give what they could, contribute what they could, and utilize their skill sets to put a person on the moon. There's a young leader in South Africa who reframed the conversation there on apartheid and said, we need to end apartheid not just for our community, but for the entire country. And if you look at the history of democracies, it's been often young leaders who have led the way in reframing issues. And the good news is that we're seeing those young leaders emerge today, and many of them are in our Millennial Action Project network. We have a group of these leaders on the Hill in the Future Caucus where I've seen them take courageous stands where they didn't just read the polls. They also saw where our country had to go. On the issue of the debt, I was so impressed when our vice chair in the last session, Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy, introduced a balanced budget amendment. She said, we do need to take fiscal responsibility seriously. And she said, we should have balanced budgets most of the time, except in moments of recession or times of war. And she's a Democrat. I was also impressed when our co-chair, a Republican in the last session, decided to make climate change one of his primary issues. And not just that, he wasn't afraid to introduce one of the most politically difficult things to do on the Republican side, and that's introducing a carbon tax. And he said we should utilize these revenues and give it back to the American people. But just to even have in all of those articles the tax in there, a Republican leader who is willing to stand up for that really shows you some of the leaders who are coming out of this generation. And now both of the Republican co-chairs in our current session, Congressman Anthony Gonzalez and Congressman Lance Gooden, are both on the record saying that we need to take climate action. And when you look at these generational trends, actually, I become fairly optimistic. When you look at Republicans under the age of 50, a majority of them believe that we need to take action on climate. And we've been talking today about how this issue of climate change has a more personal feel. Let's just take stock of the fact that that's a huge accomplishment, because I remember 10 years ago working in the climate space where that was the big problem. The effects of climate change are too diffuse and it requires too much investment up front and people don't really want to act and it's not personal enough. Now we're seeing this assumption where that is true. And we are seeing these amazing activists like Greta Thunberg who are making it personal. So it just shows that, you know, that happened in 10 years. Politics is a very human endeavor, and ideas in politics can reach the tipping point unexpectedly and exponentially, and I think we should take account of that. It is possible for that to happen in climate change. It is possible for that to happen with the national debt. Another example that really struck me recently, and a lot of examples we should be paying more attention to, is at the state level. Recently, we saw our Future Caucus in Iowa lead a renewable energy tour across the state, and we had Democrats and Republicans who were part of the legislature doing it. And I think we saw in real time how these young co-chairs of the Iowa caucus were leading the way in reframing the issue, and then more senior members of the legislature got on board with it. And they framed it in terms of why we need to make these investments in clean energy now so we can have stronger job opportunities for our citizens. They highlighted the fact that these jobs coming out are well-paying jobs to manufacture a wind turbine, to install a solar panel. And it was our Republican leaders who were making those points. Again, it just highlights this theme that when you can reframe issues in terms of the future versus the past, you can build these unlikely coalitions, get new ideas to the table. The final thing I'll say about this is I think our ability to act on generational issues like the debt and climate change are actually bigger than those individual issues. Our ability to act on these long-term threats are also about democracy itself. And sometimes your slide, Nat, about where you just feel hopeless because you have no agency and the urgency is really high, you can feel hopeless when you look at how democracy has performed in recent years. And you think about how, if you look at the debt, for example, the leaders who were primary authors of expanding the debt are no longer there, and the accountability isn't there either. So you wonder sometimes, because of this political cycle with democracy, that because you have this transfer of power, the accountability is so diffuse, people can move on. They're not held accountable for making these poor decisions. Does that mean democracy is not compatible with making long-term decisions? You could either frame it that way, or you could frame it a different way. Maybe it's because of democracy, the fact that we live in a diverse republic, because we believe in the principles of pluralism, maybe the fact that we believe in those things, that's why we actually solve these problems. And I've seen it in so many other contexts. I'm a musician. I see how in jazz, for example, when you have different ideas colliding together in a pluralistic setting, you create better music. My family has an engineering background. As an engineer, you want a diverse team because you have more ideas on the table and you can create better solutions. In business, there's study after study showing that executive leadership teams and boards of directors that are more diverse have better profits and better returns. Maybe it's because we live in a diverse democracy that we have a competition of ideas, as Madison talked about in the Federalist Papers. Maybe that's why we can solve these long-term problems. And if we can do that, I think we'll send a powerful statement about democracy and about the whole notion that people can govern themselves much better than one person can. So with that, I just want to say thank you for taking time to be here this morning. Thank you for being part of this conversation. If you want to get involved in Millennial Action Project, please reach out. And again, a big thank you to Brookings. Let's give them a round of applause.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I want to thank you. I want to thank Representative Kilmer at the beginning. I want to thank the panelists who gave us such a robust and interesting conversation about these issues. This event is not this is not the end of the event, in a sense. We saw this event as beginning what I hope will be a continuing conversation. The Millennial Action Project is I think, a crucially important organization. People associated with it, we're really glad to be involved with MAP on this issue. But we see this as the beginning of a conversation over time about how we look at these long-term issues, and particularly how those of us with some gray hair have to think differently about both communicating these issues, particularly the debt issue, which we're very heavily involved in, and how to get change in our political process. Certainly, I've learned a lot today. It's really important, I think, for those of us here at Brookings and elsewhere that are focused on the budget and the budget process to think about how to reframe these issues. The reframing issue is so important, about thinking much more about what solutions will mean for the future. We're always whining about or complaining and getting frustrated about the dangers ahead, but the importance of how we can convey to people the benefit of a solution to these, I think, has really came through very strongly. I think the whole issue of how our democracy functions, which is central to this, we felt that this whole issue of the debt and deficit is really a litmus test for whether our American democracy can handle these issues, these long-term issues, and how we can make it to do so. And finally, the importance of young leaders. I mean, Derek Kilmer, others, Stephen, others outside of the Congress is so important to this, and how what the energy and the ideas that they bring to it. So speaking for the baby boom generation, which is an awesome responsibility for me, I think we've learned a lot today about how we work together with younger Americans about how to think about these issues, how to frame them, how to enable our democracy to solve them. So thank you for being with us here today. You can keep on connecting with this project through our website and our work here at Brookings. And to be continued. Thank you.